Hello, and welcome to Tolerable Risk, the podcast for NGO, nonprofit, and charity professionals who manage risk. I'm your host, Sabrina Siegel. Today, we're going to talk to Charlie Germano. Charlie is a technology industry veteran with over 30 years of experience leading teams that build, run, and secure systems. He was recently head of information security at Save the Children US, where he led the teams responsible for protecting the data of millions of vulnerable people around the world. Charlie is now a second-year law student at the University of New Hampshire Franklin Pierce School of Law, my alma mater, where he focuses on intellectual property, technology, and information law. So thank you so much for joining Tolerable Risk. Charlie, we really appreciate having you on the podcast.
Thanks, Sabrina. I'm happy to be here.
So Charlie, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, your role, and how you got into the third sector.
Sure. So I started my career as a mainframe programmer in 1990, working on an old airline system in Denver, Colorado. Since then, I've worked a dozen or so jobs in five industries in six states across four U.S. time zones, doing a little bit of everything. I've been programming, database administration, web development, architecture, project management, program management, cybersecurity, data protection, kind of all over the map. But if you've ever flown on an airplane, gone to the movies, stayed in a hotel, or used a GPS, there's a pretty good chance you've used some system I've had a hand in. And for a little bit of context about what 1990 was like, for those of you who don't remember that far back, 1990 was a full year before the first web browser was invented, a year before the web server was released. So I've been pretty lucky to have worked through an amazing period of transformation in the technology industry. And as the power of technology has increased through that transformation, I've seen how that power can be used. Moving into the nonprofit world was really a way for me to focus on how we can use technology to help and protect people.
And that's an amazing background, Charlie. So coming from the private sector and having all these other experiences and then moving into the nonprofit, into the third sector, how is data protection and privacy viewed differently by the nonprofit sector than it is by the for-profit or the government sector? And what have you found has been really readily embraced by the third sector? And then what is rejected where you have to kind of fight your way through that?
Yeah, that's a great question because it's the same issue addressed very differently. In the third sector, the reality is that data protection, security, it's a cost center. It doesn't generate revenue. It doesn't directly drive impact to most organizations' missions. So it's tough to get visibility and priority that you need to implement some of the processes and controls to do this effectively. So that's the challenge, particularly in the third sector. Identify what the major risks are and the opportunities, prioritizing them, the ones that provide the most value or that mitigate risks, the highest risks, and just try to manage the rest. The good news is it's changing a little bit, especially with international regulations like GDPR that forced a lot of organizations' hands. For GDPR in particular, I think the threat of getting fined 4% of your global annual revenue, it sent a pretty clear message to organizations that they need to take data protection seriously. And other countries have followed suit. The U.S. unfortunately lags very far behind since we have no federal guidance here on data protection. All 50 states do it their own way. There is a bill in Congress right now that gets us something, but even that bill has some serious problems. It's better than nothing, but it needs a lot of work.
That is absolutely government regulation, something that can be both a blessing and a curse. So Charlie, imagine yourself in the shoes of the single person trying to manage data protection and privacy for a small to medium-sized nonprofit. And your fundraising team comes running into you, super thrilled, and says, "Hey, Charlie, we have a funder that wants to offer us crypto. What do you do?"
My advice would be to turn that into cash immediately for a couple of reasons. There are organizations that will do that for you. You don't even need to set up your own wallet. They will accept it on your behalf and just give you the cash for it right away. But I say this for a couple of reasons. One, if your mission has any climate or environmental related goals, I don't think that you can in good faith accept crypto. When you look at the environmental impact, that this industry has. I don't think that there's any kind of gymnastics you can perform to accept that and engage with crypto in good faith. But the other reason is much more practical. We've seen the whole crypto economy kind of collapse in the last several weeks. We've seen entire currencies just vanish, people losing their entire savings. So it's very volatile. There's really nothing that's backing these securities other than the hope that somebody else will buy it from you at a higher price than you got it for. So I would just take that crypto, turn it into cash, and use it to further your mission and just not engage in all that risk.
And what about when people ask questions about being able to do your due diligence and your KYC and saying, where is this crypto actually coming from? Because I know there's all this talk about the blockchain, blah, 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 and it's transparent. But the blockchain is only transparent according to the information that you put into it. So what advice would you give smaller organizations if they are somewhat questioning where is this donation coming from? If they can't source it, do they still accept it? Are there ways that you can dig into the blockchain and figure out where this donation may be coming from? Or is it really just trusting what someone tells you and going from there?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think it's the second one. You can trace transactions on these chains, but you're right that the identity behind those transactions is only as accurate as the information that's on them. So you can never really know. This could be crypto that was ill-gotten from a black tar heroin sale or some hack that someone got paid money for in crypto. Because hackers, especially when it comes to ransomware, they don't want US dollars. They don't want euro. They always want crypto. Always. They always want crypto 100% of the time, not 95, 100% of the time. So you're right. There is a lot of ill-gotten crypto out there, and there's really no way to know the real origin of it.
Yeah. No crypto. Stay away from it. Definitely.
Stay away from it. Definitely.
So if you have a small charity and they have limited budget and they're concerned about data protection and privacy, what advice would you give to the person who is responsible for making a business case and getting the resources necessary so that they can protect the information that the organization holds?
Great question. There are some really valuable partnerships out there. A lot of big tech companies provide a lot of consulting resources or tools or licenses specifically for nonprofits. They go way out of their way. I think partnerships can be a really valuable tool. There's an organization called NetHope that is a collection of nonprofits that go to market together to get good deals on licenses and products. A lot of big tech organizations like Microsoft has a great Tech for Social Impact team that provides consulting services and licenses and tools that help nonprofits of all sizes to effectively collect and protect data. I know Okta and Salesforce also are getting into this space. Google does a little bit. So there is some help out there, even for small nonprofits from large companies that are willing to help out a little bit.
And then how would you advise this person to communicate to their management and their leadership about what is important in this area?
I would say that leadership and particularly boards should take a broad view at the entire life cycle of data. People get the need to address cybersecurity, for example, in their board meetings because insurance companies want it. They have a lot of questions around this, but we don't do as good a job looking at the entire life cycle of data management and the risks that it proposes across the organization, from the time you collect it to the time you delete it. So, you know, what's a financial risk? What's a reputational risk, a cyber risk, an operational risk? Without looking at the overall landscape, what data are you collecting and why? Do you really need it? Is any of it sensitive? How long do you need it? Can you identify and protect it through all points of the life cycle? So kind of take a broad view of all the risks that collecting data presents and looking at it from a high level instead of kind of pigeonholing the risks.
Yeah, that's a great point, Charlie. When I was doing data protection and privacy and GDPR compliance work, I always tried to communicate to the teams that I was working with that this was actually a systems approach, right? It's not any one thing. It's not, do we have a firewall or even do we have permission slips when we're taking photographs or using quotes of people? But it's exactly what you said, thinking about from the beginning, why are we collecting this data? I always loved challenging the data that was on old forms and saying, why are we collecting this? Well, we've always collected it. Nope, not a good enough reason, right? Why are we collecting this? What are we actually doing? Let's follow this piece of data through the system and see where it goes. And if we're asking for the same piece of data on six different forms, let's only ask for it on one, right? And then exactly what you said, where is it being stored? How long is it being stored? So very good points there, Charlie.
Absolutely.
What are some concepts or themes of data protection and privacy that you think people get wrong in the third sector?
Oh, I had so many people come to me and say things like, I don't care if anyone gets my emails. There's nothing interesting in them anyway. And that it's a uniquely Western privilege, I feel like, because we have the luxury, most of us, to differentiate between our data privacy and our physical security in the real world. But adversaries don't draw that line. They know that if they get enough information on you, where do your kids go to school, right? What is the password that you need to collect them from school early? This is valuable information that they can use to affect your life and in the physical world. And that's people who have the privilege of saying, my emails are not important. Whereas many people that are receiving aid from third sector organizations, they're vulnerable people by nature, and they could be in physical danger if their relationship with the NGO is revealed. This issue in particular, however anyone feels about this issue, the recent Dobbs decision from the Supreme Court sent a wake-up call to a lot of people, because suddenly people can be held liable for helping other people cross state lines, right? So if you're texting with someone, say, oh, come to my state to this medical procedure, now all of a sudden you're at risk, and that can be proven by what's in your text. So I'm not a lawyer. This is not legal advice, but if you're texting anything sensitive, consider using a product like Signal and using the vanishing messaging map feature that encrypts your data end to end and protects you and whoever you're communicating with. But again, this is something that we need to reframe the message on, because there is definitely something interesting in your emails to somebody.
That's such a great point. I really love your thought about considering privilege when we're thinking about something, even as what we think is as black and white as data protection and privacy, but the privilege of your position will influence then how much attention and resources are given to this area. And it might be very different from the privilege level of the person who might be impacted. So that's a really interesting angle. I had never thought of it like that before. So what would you say are the top three risks within data protection and privacy that third sector organizations should really be aware of?
I think I would start by thinking about who are the people that are trying to access your most sensitive data, right? And what would they do with it if they succeeded? So start gaming that out. What do you have that somebody could do something tough with? So I would start by asking that question. And then I'd probably take that a step further and say, if you did have a breach of your most sensitive data, do you know what you would do? I mean, what would you do? What lawyers would you call, or what insurance company, or do you have crisis communications that are ready to go? What regulatory authorities do you need to report to? And in particular, and this is the biggest one, when's the last time you tested that process? Because writing a document and having a policy and putting it in a drawer does nobody any good. I think that those things should probably be tested a couple times a year, if not quarterly, because these are perishable skills. And to the policy aspect, do you have a data lifecycle management policy with input from across the organization, from legal and compliance and ethics teams and your business and technical teams? Do you have a diverse set of perspectives creating those policies? And can you show that you're complying with them? I think when you're creating a data protection program, those are all things that you need to be creating and monitoring and thinking about, not just when there's an emergency, but these are pre-incident activities that can save you a lot of headaches down the road.
Absolutely. Again, I agree with you. I guess the question is, and here I'm going to ask you the how long is a piece of string question. How many policies and processes do organizations need to have in this area? If you were going to advise and saying, look, guys, no fooling around, in writing, at a minimum, processes on the following elements, what would you recommend?
Yeah, I'm with you. The smaller the number for your need, the better. I don't know if you can get away with one, but as long as you can identify what data you're collecting and how you can manage it through the whole life cycle, including when you delete it. And that's one that doesn't get a lot of airtime. Collecting data is so easy now. You don't even think of it. And it's cheap. It's cheap to store it, but it's a liability. So if you know what you have, where it is, and you know how to delete it when it's time, I think that's enough.
That's great. And then what do you think about the frequency or the intensity of staff training when it comes to data protection and privacy? Do you need to have something once a quarter, once a year? Do you need to have pop-ups that come up on your screen and remind you not to stick that USB stick that you found in the parking lot into your computer? For small to medium-sized organizations, what would you advise them to do in this area around data protection and privacy training and communication?
Yeah, you know, I feel like the annual check the box, I'm not going to click on stupid things in emails, activities. I don't know how effective those are. I feel like the school of thought is evolving on that. I think it's probably easier for some of these things to implement technical controls. Like, we train you to not click on weird links in emails, but now our tools are good enough where we can filter a lot of that out. And you should be able to click on a link in an email. A lot of people who I used to work with are probably throwing things at their computer right now listening to this because I spent so long saying don't click on things in emails. But you should be able to trust your email inbox. You should be able to do that. I think for a lot of these things, we can implement technical controls on them. Obviously, we need training to make sure that people don't print things off and leave it on the subway. And that's a whole different risk. There's no technical control for that. It's more of a cultural training. It needs to be exhibited and seen every day. I don't know about the once annual, you know, I'm going to go through and check C on all of these things and hope I get enough to pass so I don't have to take it again. But the training on these are getting better. But again, I feel like it's more of a cultural and even a technical challenge, once annual compliance training.
Yeah. So maybe trying to think about how organizations can integrate some of these concepts into their ways of working and their processes instead of having it be something that's thought about after the fact. So when someone is going through information collection, maybe you have some guidelines there. If they're going to create a form that say, you know, think about these things so that data protection and privacy are being integrated instead of it's Charlie running after you going, do you need all of those things in your form? In my previous roles, when I would do that, you know, sometimes people got it and sometimes people were like, oh, there's the compliance person again. Why is she here? I promise I'm doing you a favor.
Absolutely. I got a text recently from a former colleague that the whole text was, what was that thing you made us put on our phones that made everyone hate you? So I was not
aware. What was that thing, Charlie? What was that thing that you made everyone put on their phones?
It was a mobile device management tool. I'm not going to call it out because there's nothing wrong with the tool, but everyone really did hate me. It was true.
They thought you were monitoring their thoughts like Major League Baseball.
reading the text, looking at the pictures, and it was none of that. We just needed to protect the data in case they left it on the subway.
Right, a remote wipe kind of tool. So in case someone finds it, you can brick it. And a lot of people have that on their personal devices, though. And I think it's a good tool to have. So we had talked a little bit earlier about how you would get management and leadership on board with understanding the importance of all this. How would you advise, particularly board members, to engage with and best support data protection and privacy?
I think it's a lot of what we talked about before about taking the broader view, right? Instead of just focusing on the individual, like the financial risk or the cyber risk, look at the risks of the entire data lifecycle management as both an asset and a liability.
So if you we're going to help the Charlie Germano that is working at a small NGO, you know, fight for some budget when it comes to data protection and privacy resourcing. What would you encourage them to put in their presentation to get some resources?
So I would say start by trying to quantify a risk, right? So what is the risk that we're carrying by collecting sensitive data? In fact, just this morning, I was reading an article. IBM every year releases stats on the frequency and the damages from breaches. We're up to $4.5 million per average per breach for US organizations. So putting stats like that, and they're readily available, putting stats like that in a board presentation is pretty effective, because if you're asking for some number of thousands of dollars to mitigate a multi-million dollar risk, that seems like a pretty good bet to people. So
that does seem like a pretty good bet, I would say. Okay, let's put yourself in the seat of a board member. So if you are a board member for a small or medium-sized NGO, what are three questions that board members should be asking their organizations relating to risks with data protection and privacy? And I will tip my hand a little bit here. for people who follow me on LinkedIn and know I hate the red, yellow, and green matrices. I want to burn them with fire. There is no value in them. So instead of asking for a risk matrix as a board member, what should board members be asking for so that they can perform their oversight and monitoring role in the data protection and privacy area?
Yeah, well, if you want to burn those matrices, I will help you light the match. Yay! Because they're tedious and not super helpful. So I'm right there with you on that. But, you know, as far as the risk, we know that we'll never control them all. There are risks that we just accept, especially in the third sector, by the nature of the existence or of the organization. You're taking risks, right? Maybe you're operating in certain countries that are not always safe, or certain environments. So you're taking risks. I would ask, what are the risks that we're willing to accept that are just by the nature of us existing, we just have to live with? Because knowing that is valuable. Beyond that, I would say, going back to the crisis response, the incident response processes, do we know what we would do if something bad happened? And do we test that? I think testing that process and those policies, if I had one thing to say, it's if something bad happens, know what you're going to do before it happens and practice it. Because by the time it happens, it's just too late. And finally, if you look at whether it's GDPR or any of the cybersecurity frameworks like NIST or ISO or whatever, they always start with the same couple of questions. What do you have and where do you have it? So just having an inventory, knowing where your data lives, because I guarantee you it's not just where you think it is. It's on 1,000 spreadsheets. It's backed up into weird servers that you forgot about. It's on some external hard drive in somebody's desk. But just knowing where your data is, if I were bored, I would want to make sure that my operational teams had a handle on that and could answer that question.
I love that. That, I think, distills our whole conversation down. What do you have? And where do you have it? That's brilliant. Those would be the questions that you would want to be able to answer, and without hesitation, right? You want people to be able to answer that question affirmatively and confidently. So you brought up GDPR a few times, and I've been hesitant to dip my toe in that water, but 4 years on from GDPR, what do you think? What have we learned? I know from the US point of view, implementing GDPR is slightly different than if you were sitting in Europe or internationally, but what should small and medium-sized charities think about when they think about GDPR?
So GDPR, the good news about GDPR is, and I'm not saying I've had to make a report to the ICO, but I'm not saying I haven't. It's remarkably easy to comply with if you do the homework ahead of time. And those two questions we just talked about, what do you have and where do you have it? That's about 90% of it. The entire process of filing a report and complying with GDPR, it's only a few pages. You know, what was the data? How many people? Where did they live? What kind of data? That's kind of it. The real problem is in the US, because it's all 50 states doing something different. They all define what is PII differently. Some states, it's your maiden name. Some states, it's your mother's maiden name. Some states, it's your birthday. Some states, it's not. It's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. The fact that our legislature can agree on, this is something that will help businesses, it will help consumers, it will help everyone. I really hope they do something soon, because right now it's a mess. I think the other thing we've learned from GDPR is they seem to be pretty lenient with folks in the third sector. They're less lenient with big, giant multinational corporations. It seems like the Googles of the world, when they have an incident, the bidding starts at $50 million. I haven't seen a whole lot of really strict enforcement for nonprofit or third sector organization. So that's good news. It's really not that onerous to comply with once you've done the little bit of homework that you have to do. And we haven't seen really a lot of harsh penalties for third sector organizations.
And that's good to see. I think you mentioned earlier the penalty is what, 4% of the gross?
Global annual.
Global annual. And if you're thinking about it from a nonprofit, you're kind of like, I mean,
right?
What do we even have? But if you are a small organization and you are outsourcing and you're doing a lot of software as a service and you're doing a lot of kind of cloud-based stuff, you would want to make sure your vendors are compliant and asking them the right questions, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So what would be some of the questions that you would advise smaller organizations to ask of their vendors? Are there particular documents that they should ask them to present to make sure they have them? Is there a certification or something that they should be asking about? What should they ask so that they can get assurances from their vendors?
That's a great question. I don't know if there are actually certifications. I think vendors are more than happy to tell you if they're GDPR compliant or not. So if they're not telling you, that's a red flag. And if they're not, then I would start asking questions like, okay, so where do you store and process this data? Does it ever cross into the EU? Because once, even if you're only collecting data from people in Kansas, if it's stored on a backup server in Spain, all of a sudden you've got some compliance issues. So yeah, I would definitely see any organization that doesn't tell you up front that they're GDPR compliant, that's a red flag, because most of them just do automatically.
So asking just the very blunt, direct question, tell us about your GDPR compliance, and then they can answer that and tell you what they think. So how do you stay on top of risks and changing information and trends in data protection and privacy?
I read a lot generally. I would say as far as ongoing education, this world changes faster than universities can really develop curricula for it. Some organizations I do follow, like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, they do a lot of interesting research in this space. The ACLU is also pretty vocal about this for folks in the US. I subscribe to some newsletters. Lexology is one that has specific data protection subject area that will keep you current with legislation, regulations, and court cases and interesting things. But yeah, those are where I get most of my current events from.
That's really helpful. And for small and medium-sized NGOs and charities, what are some tools that you could recommend for folks in the third sector who want to learn more about or who want to improve their skill sets in the areas of data protection and privacy?
I go back to some of the bigger tech companies. Microsoft is great at this. Amazon's pretty good at this. They'll just publish things on their websites that are pretty accessible, and they'll generally give that stuff away for free. Also, there are smaller local conferences. Even before COVID, I was starting to get a little weary of the large 50,000 people in Vegas or whatever. In the cyber world, there was something called B-Sides, which is really just kind of local practitioners that get together and you could actually have a conversation with people in your area and in your field. So I would look more locally for this kind of continuing education rather than the large global kind of events.
I've seen in some places people saying, oh, well, particularly for things like cybersecurity or data protection and privacy, reach out to your local university. They may be able to give you pro bono support or something like that.
There are consulting companies sometimes have pro bono type practices where if you're lucky enough to be in an NGO that's large enough to have a corporate partnerships department, that those guys can typically arrange for some short-term project-based support that I have seen be effective.
So, Charlie, is there anything else that we didn't cover today? Any other words of wisdom that you would give to a lone data protection guy or gal that's listening to this podcast and going, oh my God, I have all these things to think about? What advice would you give them working in the charity sector and overall trying to make sure all this stuff is taken care of?
Oh, well, for the lone person at a small nonprofit, first I would say thank you. What you're doing matters. I think if you approach every day knowing that you're going to have risk, just have a plan, make whatever partnerships you can based on where you are, whether it's local or some of the bigger tech companies that provide free consulting or licenses. I've mentioned Microsoft Tech for Social Impact a few times. That's one that I would really recommend if you're a small NGO. Reach out to those guys. They provide cheap licenses. They'll help you implement tools and walk you through the whole process. They don't just dump you with some software that it's then up to you to deploy and manage. They'll help you with the whole life cycle.
That's a good recommendation. So, Charlie, if folks out there are listening to this and they're like, wow, Charlie Germano is super awesome, I want to get in touch with him, I have some more questions, where can they find you?
Probably LinkedIn is the best place to find me.
Okay, great. Wonderful. Thank you so much for chatting today, everybody. This was Charlie Germano, and he was chatting with us about data protection and privacy and what small and medium-sized NGOs and third sector folks need to be thinking about. So thanks. Appreciate having you.
Thanks, Sabrina. This was fun.
Great. So that's our show for today. Please remember to like, subscribe, and follow us for all your third sector risk information. Thanks for listening to Tolerable Risk.